I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, late last month, Reuters dropped a bombshell news report revealing that Enrique Tarrio, a leader of the far-right Proud Boys, has a history acting as a quote-unquote prolific informant for federal and local law enforcement. Does Tarrio's past history as a federal informant merit closer examination in light of the January 6th storming of the Capitol? And moreover, does it raise questions about the FBI's operating of confidential sources? Our guest on this edition of the program, retired special agent Colleen Raleigh, believes the answer to both those questions is yes. For those unfamiliar, Raleigh became known as a whistleblower in the aftermath of 9/11, testifying to both the Senate and the 9/11 Commission on matters related to FBI fillings in the lead-up to 9/11. In that time period, Raleigh's public profile exploded, eventually leading the FBI agent to be featured on the cover of Time magazine. She joins us on this edition of the program to discuss her op-ed for Consortium News entitled Curiouser and Curiouser, the Proud Boys leader as a prolific law enforcement confidential source. In this conversation, Raleigh expands on many of the points made in that piece and gives an insight into the problematic issues of operating confidential sources, at least in the way they are operated currently by federal law enforcement. As you'll hear in this conversation, much of Raleigh's analysis lines up with that of journalist Trevor Aronson, author of The Terror Factory Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. A book, I might add, that is highly worth reading. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views, and now on to the conversation with retired FBI Special Agent Colleen Raleigh on the questions that need to be raised in light of the news that Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio has a past history as a federal informant. Welcome to Parallax Views, former special agent with the FBI, Colleen Raleigh. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. We're cold in Minnesota, but otherwise fine.
So I wanted to have you on the program because you have this article out on Consortium News, Curiouser and Curiouser, the Proud Boys leader as a prolific law enforcement confidential source. Tell us a little bit more about your background and what led you to look at this news story that has sort of been memory-holed with regards to the Proud Boys leader that was working as confidential source for law enforcement.
Right. I like the title from Alice in Wonderland, Curiouser, because essentially I was just trying to bring up some logical questions that people should be asking about this whole thing. My background is that I joined the FBI just a couple years after the Church Committee, when in fact this lull existed between the Vietnam War and then the new post 9/11 wars. And in that lull, the FBI, actually it was the Attorney General, forced the FBI to adopt stricter Attorney General guidelines as a result of J. Edgar Hoover's abuses. And these guidelines covered all different investigative areas. There was at least, 7, 8, 10 different AG guidelines. One set was for the handling of informants. But frankly, the one set that was much more restrictive, because Hoover, with COINTELPRO, had, of course, been infiltrating a lot of groups. And, you know, even if there is somebody in a group who is not necessarily, a good guy or doing something, they would infiltrate the whole group. They would collect information on everyone. Hoover went on, of course, to plant microphones in hotel rooms to intercept Martin Luther King. He, spied on feminist groups, all kinds of abuses. I actually personally had the opportunity to review some of the COINTELPRO files when I first joined. The reason for that was because the National Lawyers Guild, if you can imagine, was one of the groups targeted. And there were files, just stacked up in every office, up to the ceiling in some offices, that because after years and years, the National Lawyers Guild won a FOIA lawsuit. So they won this FOIA lawsuit, which meant all those files had to be processed and redacted. And I went through the files in one of the offices, and I was frankly pretty amazed at the extent of all this spying that went on. So I had other experiences in the FBI. Of course, I'm known for not tolerating a lot of obfuscation. And, when problems happen, any organization does not want to tell the truth about it. They hate to air the dirty laundry. And so I got into this after 9/11 memo to tell the Joint Intelligence Committee what questions to ask when they were trying to look at some of the 9/11 failures. Because before that, they didn't even know. The FBI was not even telling the Joint Intelligence Committee what had gone on. So I wrote that memo and got my picture on Time magazine, et cetera. But the problem is, since that time of 9/11, it all went south. They used 9/11 as the so-called New Pearl Harbor. And the new Pearl Harbor then, you know what it turned out to be? Those AG guidelines, first of all, got diluted. They initially got diluted and eventually pretty much done away with over the years. There were a couple of different key decisions, and then they watered them down. And eventually they just said, we're going to make up all new ones, but the new guidelines really don't have any evidence. You don't have to have real solid evidence in order to target groups. 9/11 just skewed everything, in my opinion. We went to war on countries that had nothing to do with it. It's a mess and a half. And in effect, people should not be surprised at the mess we're in right now because of all the stuff that has happened since 9/11. It was a shock, like the shock doctrine. And when a shock occurs in a country, it allows these elite people who have prior agendas then to say, oh, we have to carry out our agenda because of this thing that happened. And I think that a lot of this has really been bad. So that's my background. And when I wrote this article about the fact that one of the Proud Boys, well, the leader, the self-described leader of the Proud Boys, an Afro-Cuban guy from Florida.
Enrique Tarrio, right?
Yeah, Enrique Tarrio. It turned out that he had this prior record. you know, some years ago of being operated not just once, but repeatedly by the FBI there's different categories. And one is, of course, confidential informant. That's where your identity never becomes known. But in his case, it looks more like he was a cooperating witness. And frankly, the category of cooperating witness has less potential for abuse in a cooperating witness. The reason is eventually that witness is going to testify in trial. And a prosecutor knows about it. And because of the fact that there's that little bit of openness and transparency, because at trial, things will come out, that actually has less potential for abuse. An informant, an actual secret informant, we all know, of course, with the history of Whitey Bulger. And, you know, basically, Whitey Bulger was the tip of the iceberg. There's all kinds of problems in operating these high-level criminals. You only know a part of it with Whitey Bulger, because there was many, many more than that. And in fact, there's an entire book now, since the all of these stings, the FBI stings that occurred after 9/11, you know, where informants would go into mosques and different groups, and sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes prey on vulnerable people, emotionally, mentally ill, definitely economically vulnerable people, and by, you know, certain amount of coercion by influence, by using their influence, many of these informants got con artist skills. They can con people and they can put pressure on people. And in fact, those are the ones that are successful, tend to be successful, is that they're pretty good at manipulation. And if they manipulate people into doing something that they wouldn't otherwise have done, as this book documented, a lot of these cases, what are we accomplishing there? What are we accomplishing? We're not accomplishing anything, except guess what? The agents get rewarded. The informant gets rewarded, oftentimes in excess of six figures a year of money. And so there's a lot of area of abuse this way. And when I saw that one of these leaders of a militia movement had actually been a cooperating witness, I just wrote the article because I thought it would be educational for people. And you're right. I guess people, oftentimes it's kind of sad. They prefer not to know some of this stuff in a way. It's kind of sad that people, when you do, and this isn't the first time for me, but I brought up some pretty bad things and people just like, oh, I don't want to know that. I don't know. I don't want to know if the FBI is incompetent or doing something wrong. I prefer to believe in those TV shows, Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. And all of these other shows on television where, you know, it's good guys versus bad guys, and they don't want to know the complexity and the details about it.
I was going to add, so with this Tario guy, is it possible that he can take this money he's getting from the feds and, you know, funnel that back into maybe these far right wing movements, these militia activities, Proud Boy activities? Well, also maybe only selectively informing to the FBI on sort of what he wants to tell them and what he doesn't want to tell them.
Well, that's a good question, because pretty much all of the confidential informants, at least a great many of them, do only selectively inform. Now, the best example of this, of course, I'm going to go back to Whitey Bulger. The reason I talk about him, top echelon Boston organized crime informant that the FBI operated for a couple of decades while he was murdering. His gang was murdering other people in Boston, and yet the FBI was paying him lots of money. And, you know, it wasn't just one agent. One agent did go to prison for this later on when the FBI could not suppress it any longer. By the way, this only came out because of a curious judge who pried into the file. Normally, judges are not allowed to know informant identities, but this judge was prying into it, and that's how it became known. But in his case, as a good example, he was informing on Italian organized crime rivals. So he was informing on his enemy rivals to the FBI. He sure was not telling the FBI about his own murders. And you know what? That happens all the time. I think there's another really old scandal that occurred, and I'm not real conversant with it, but it was something like this. There was an entire group. I want to say it had something to do. I don't want to get myself in trouble here because it's kind of vague in my memory, but it had something to do with the Anti-Defamation League, I think, and maybe another group. But they, of course, were giving information to the FBI, but they were giving information on their enemies. And so, and typically that's the big motive. A big motive for an informant to come in and tell you something is because they're ratting out somebody they don't like or somebody that they see as a rival. It can be rival groups. It can be all kinds of things. So in fact, what the job of the FBI is you can't take that information at face value because they're very motivated to tell you bad things about other people. You know, a lot of it does depend upon the motivation of the confidential source. Every great once in a while. Now, this is what I said in the article. We have something called a good citizen category. Now, this could be somebody who's actually, let's say, a victim of a blackmail. You know, not their fault. It could be also somebody who's low level. Let's say you're working as the accountant for Bernie Madoff. And, you know, eventually after a few years, you start figuring out that Bernie Madoff doesn't really have this money invested. And then you walk into the FBI and you say, hey, I got some suspicions here and I'll act as an informant for you, etc. Once in a while that happens. But the majority of times it's because people are motivated. And when they're motivated to rat out somebody else, many times it's because they're covering up for themselves or for their own group.
I was going to add to that. I love this line you have about FBI officials have always defended the practice, arguing that there's no other way to get needed information about criminal activities without dealing with quote unquote the devil. What's interesting to me about that is if you are dealing with the devil, there's always a chance you're going to get burned by that devil. And I think that's the really key point here in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's always, and you know, it's actually a little more than an excuse. It's true. People watch TV shows. They watch a forensic show like Bones, and she's able to figure out the whole crime just by looking at the bones. You know, no, that's not true. These things are not true. And so you absolutely need inside information almost always in order to solve a case. So it's more than an excuse, but it also, here's my point on there. It also serves as more than, it allows some really bad things to go on for a long time too. Because once you give yourself that ego thing, oh, well, we have to deal with these bad guys. Yeah, they might be murdering other people, but that's the way it is. And once you do that, of course, it's a very slippery slope. There's, if your listeners Google, they can find this old 60 Minutes. It's probably 5, 7, 10 years old now, but there's an old 60 Minutes show. And it was about a supervisor in New York City who actually was for a short period of time, my own supervisor. His name was Lynn DeVecchio. And Lynn DeVecchio was operating, again, this is the problem. You shouldn't be opening up the leaders of the criminal organizations. The FBI was blind. And I'm just going to say this as I'm diverting here, because what you said is, you know, this is the excuse, but this is where it goes too far. They went so far as to say, not only do we open up lower level and less complicit people in a criminal organization, but we can operate the leader of the organization. And it was called Top Echelon. So that, you know, most people would say, what? The FBI is operating the leaders of the criminal group or whatever? I mean, that's really what goes too far. Well, anyway, DeVecchio was operating one of the leaders of the Colombo family, who, just like Bulger, was murdering people. And he operated him for 20 years. There is a whole 60 Minutes expose on this. And DeVecchio ended up being prosecuted for murder himself. My own supervisor was prosecuted for manslaughter murder, and he narrowly got off, but he did get scolded by the judge. And when he's on 60 Minutes, guess what he says? He kind of looks, he kind of gives this little sly smile and says, but you know, don't you understand, people? We have to deal with criminals and deal with the devil, essentially. So he says the same thing on that show. And he's not totally wrong, but on the other hand, you can't be allowing your law enforcement to be operating really bad criminals. You can't allow that.
Now, in regards to the FBI, how does it benefit from these type of post 9/11 operations? You mentioned Trevor Aronson. He gets into that deeply in his work. But how do they really benefit from all of this?
Well, they benefit in a lot of ways. The individual agents, of course, you often see defense attorneys when they're on witness stands later on, they're trying to say, hey, didn't you get an award for this? You know, how much did you pay this informant? And there are various ways where they try to minimize that. Oftentimes the informant is not paid till after the trial. That's a key way to minimize it. That way if the cooperating witness is testifying, they don't have to say how much they got paid, because they wait until afterwards. And it's the same thing with the agents. So individuals get paid. So that's one way of they benefit. It has nothing to do necessarily. Now we would hope that many of these cases, there is also the proper law enforcement motive of trying to actually catch someone who's done a crime, or to also prevent a crime. Very rarely, by the way, is a crime prevented. It's more often that you actually can prosecute someone for something they did afterwards. But guess what else is? There's another motivation here. After 9/11, because terrorism increased in the world, it did not decrease. With all the dumb things that Bush and Cheney did, it made a lot of people mad around the world. And, you know, I think Mueller at the time knew that terrorism and potential terrorism was going to increase. Now, how do you deflect from public being, you know, the public was already concerned that 9/11 happened, let alone if more things happened. So by this, these stings that were almost, there's a tape saying we're going to orchestrate the sting like Hollywood. We're going to stage it like Hollywood. This is in Trevor Aronson, you know, in his book and stuff. But in these stings, this allowed the public to believe that the FBI was making progress in deterring real terrorism. And in fact, it was a few years before we started to have the Boston bombing and the underwear bomber and the Times Square bomber. And there's been many others. And now it's kind of degenerated, I think, mostly into these senseless mass shootings. But I think even the senseless mass shootings, which are just, you know, horrible, the graph for those things they went up, you know, 100-fold. We never had that kind of thing before 9/11, mass shootings. We had a few, but nothing like now. And I think a lot of this, the public, if they knew that this was all connected to these dumb way of addressing the use of 9/11 as a Pearl Harbor and all these dumb things they had done, I think the public would be mad. But instead, I think they get misled, and they, like Trevor Aronson's book explains, so many of these stings are, you know, they put them on TV. Oh, look, the FBI prevented, this city was going to be bombed. And you'll never know if that would have happened or not, because a lot of these cases, it's pressuring people to you know, look, staging something Hollywood. So that's a big motivation. It was a organizational motivation to also deflect blame, I think, and protect against criticism.
And I want to note that Trevor Aronson book is called The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. Is there any oversight or adequate control done when it comes to the operation of these informants, or is it done in total secrecy?
Well, there is an inherent problem with, like I said before, the difference between cooperating witnesses, where they do end up becoming public and going on witness stands. But with confidential informants, they're covered by almost total secrecy, and actually perpetual secrecy, even when they commit crimes. Like I was mentioning, even in the Whitey Bulger case, it's a rare case, even in such abuses like that they become known. So what is supposed to happen is there's supposed to be internal oversight. You know, for a while, the FBI was allowed to conduct all of its own, personnel problems. So that no one ever got to check the FBI. So if an FBI agent was drunk driving and killed people, that remained solely inside the FBI. The Department of Justice, the Inspector General, no one looked at that except the FBI. And after a while, they said, you can't be governing yourself this way, because you have a solid motive not to tell the public when bad things happen. And the same thing happened a little bit with informants after Whitey Bulger. At that point, the Inspector General then began to review files, and they went to, I think, actually all 56 field offices at about 2004 or 5, something like that. They went to all the offices, and almost all the offices miserably failed. They were not looking, like I said, if you opened up criminal informants that were conducting further crimes, there's supposed to be a review, probably a supervisor. There's different compliance mechanisms, internal ones that are supposed to be followed. And back right after 9/11, 2005, the Department of Justice found that the FBI's oversight was horrible. Now, they've done this periodically since, and I saw one from 2019, and I have the link in my article, and you can just read the first page of that report, and it doesn't look like anything improved. It looks like almost nothing improved. And again, you go back to airing the dirty laundry. How many people, first of all, read these reports? How many people read Inspector General reports about agency abuses? It almost, you know, the Church Committee, when they uncovered Hoover's and the CIA and the NSA, it wasn't just the FBI, but all these abuses, that was because there was a lot of pressure. There was media pressure, Frank Church himself, I mean, the senators did this. But I don't see that happening at all now. The only little thing I see is Trevor Aronson's book. I don't see hardly any official or media emphasis on these issues. And yet, yeah, if you look at the IG report, even from 2019, it's not good. It looks like there's been a ton of, you know, non-compliance and all kinds of things. Oh, by the way, once in a while, there will be a news article. I remember a news article out of California where there was an informant they sent into a mosque, and he was like, I think he was sleeping with some of the people he was targeting. He was maybe even dealing in all kinds of icky things that he was dealing. You know, the only reason that came out in the news article is the informant himself went to the media and said, hey, look what I was doing. So there have been some little things like this, but by and large, there's been almost no public concern about it.
Now, before we close out, I just had maybe two more questions. The first, I think when a lot of people hear that Tarrio was a confidential source for the feds, the people immediately get this picture in their head for some reason that, oh, it must be that the FBI directly instigated what happened in the Capitol. I don't think that's necessarily what happened. Could you clear that maybe misconception up?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's another reason I wrote the article. When I wrote the article, I did want to make it clear that his prior cooperation with the FBI, or it could have been also the Drug Enforcement Agency, those two, maybe both. His cooperation had been years ago. And so, yeah, you know, after one of these times where you cooperate, it's not that you remain an informant forever or a cooperating witness. No, the file gets closed afterwards. So that was probably what happened. Although I also what happens is that even though a source is closed, they can be easily reopened. And so even in cases where a bad source, for instance, you know, committed a crime and you had to close the file because they committed a crime that was not authorized, you know what? Those can get reopened later on. And those informants and those sources always have an incentive to get juicy information. So from their perspective, and especially if they ever get hard up for money, and they want to go back to cooperating, if they get juicy information, they can just go in and yes, the FBI will look up their file and say, oh yeah, you were a good informant. We can open you right back up again. So it's no way to know. I kind of doubt that the FBI had anything to do other than they might have done this. They might have said, you know, you tell us if there's any thing going on or if there's any, you know, drug dealing or anything like that. There may have been something like that. I really would doubt that they were had anything to do with the actual chaos and, you know, the violence that occurred on June 6th. I really don't think that would be the case. Although, okay, in history, there are these bad cases before where, again, even groups and organizations were used to target rival organizations. So you have to keep an open mind. And by the, you know, my title is curious, because people should be curious and should be, even in this impeachment, trial going on, Congress should be asking some of these questions. They should be curious about these things, but they're not. They don't want to know.
I was going to add real quickly to that. The thing that gets me is that these figures like Tario, and I'm assuming there's many more of them that played a role in the January 6th storming of the Capitol, if they were acting informants and getting these big bucks from the feds, they could have been taking that money from the feds and, you know, funneling it back into organizing things like what happened on January 6th. The only other thing I want to add here, I wanted to get your take. Can there be any reform that can be done to prevent this problem when it comes to how these confidential sources are operated?
Okay, to answer the first question, the FBI does not monitor at all, to my knowledge, what a source does with their money. The only thing they tell them is they're supposed to pay income taxes. But even that is almost, you know, again, this has been my observation, is that in years gone by, they were never careful to, they don't tell the IRS, for instance. So even in those cases, the guy probably, you know, does not have to pay income taxes on the money in many, many cases. The second question is reform. Yes, there's all kinds of good suggestions for reform. And in fact, these Department of Justice Inspector General reports have laid out reforms that were supposed to occur. The Whitey Bulger case alone had a big report. And one of the things, you know, that they said is, you know, why are you operating top echelons? You know, that's the leader of the criminal group. You shouldn't be operating the leader. You should, if you're going to be getting information, you should be getting it from the people at the lower levels. If you think about let's think about a drug operation. Okay, in a drug operation, if you get information, you would be getting it from the lower levels in order to prosecute the more complicit people who are organizing it. You wouldn't be getting it from the top guy who's organizing it in order to take down the little guys. I mean, that's one of the things, but I'm not sure how many of these reforms have ever really gone into place. Looking at the cover page of that 2019, it says a lot of the things that the FBI has been told to do in order to reform have not been accomplished. One major reform, very easy to do, is that this notion of preventing crime is specious itself. And so, we'd love to believe that you can prevent crimes, but that gets into minority, what do you call that movie,
Minority Report.
Yeah, Minority Report. People want to believe that can happen. They watch these shows. But you know what? That's a specious notion. The best that can usually be done, if you want to be accurate, is that you already have the evidence of a crime that has occurred already. And then in those cases, by prosecuting the person, that way you're preventing future crimes. But you're not going to, like, this other notion of sting operations is very specious. Cooperating witnesses are always going to be less capable and susceptible to abuse than secret, perpetually secret, but highly paid informants whose identity is not known to anyone except, a case agent and maybe their supervisor. That alone. So a lot of cases, when I worked in New York City on organized crime, guess what? We used a lot of cooperating witnesses. Those cooperating witnesses ended up testifying. And so they really couldn't do this. They couldn't do bad things, because they were going to be known. And there was a lot of oversight and a lot of, they were subject to a lot more restrictions than an informant. So that alone is one big reform, is that they should go more to cooperating witnesses than to informants.
Well, Colleen Rowley, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. If there's anything else you want to add, I always like to end on a positive note, maybe let listeners know how they can keep up with your work or anything else that you want to add as a final comment.
Well, after 20 years and being retired for 15 years, I don't really write that much anymore. When I do, it's usually on Consortium News. Or I'm in a group now with some retired military officers called the Eisenhower Media Network. You'll have to have some of them on. One of them is a retired major, Danny Shorson. And I would highly recommend that he come on because he saw so much of this post 9/11, war stuff that went on. And he's very, very astute about it. So that's what I'm involved in those things. But it's been a very frustrating, I have to say, it's hard to be too optimistic with the impeachment going on and the country so polarized. I think we're in a mess. I honestly think it's up to the public. Hillary Clinton called the public deplorables. And I think that, it's up to us deplorables now to kind of fix this mess. I don't think Washington, D.C. is going to fix it. I think it's going to be the people.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Colleen Rowley, retired FBI special agent, on the bombshell news that Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio has a history as an informant for federal and local law enforcement. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Amelia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.